This is the July 2020 Negligence Update CLE course based on appellate decisions, New York State appellate decisions released in the month of July 2020 and summarized on the website New York Appellate Digest. The summaries have been compiled into a July 2020 Negligence Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for the course, and the page references are to the pamphlet. The first case is Anderson on page 7. It has to do with the continuous representation doctrine, which told the statute of limitations in this architectural malpractice case. The second department, reversing Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact about whether the continuous representation doctrine told the statute of limitations in this architectural malpractice breach of contract action. Defendant's decedent was hired by plaintiff to construct a four-story condominium. Although the work was completed in 2008, there were problems getting approval by the city, and new architectural services contracts were entered in 2015 and 2018. The court wrote, "The plaintiff raised a question of fact as to whether the continuous representation toll applied. The plaintiff averred in an affidavit in opposition to the motion that defendant's decedent continued to work on the project from 2008 through the time that the parties entered into the 2015 agreement, including by continuing to revise the plans so as to subdivide the property, regularly meeting with the plaintiff, renewing building permits with the plaintiff, meeting with the commissioner at the New York City Department of Buildings to discuss revised plans, and filing an application concerning the project with the Department of Buildings in 2014. Next is Waring versus Matalon on page 9, medical malpractice case. The second department held plaintiff mother's action for damages for emotional harm stemming from the birth of her child was properly dismissed. A mother cannot recover for emotional distress for injury in utero if the child is born alive. The court wrote, "A mother cannot recover damages for emotional harm where the alleged malpractice causes in utero injury to a fetus that is born alive. New York State public health law defines a live birth as the complete expulsion or extraction from its mother or a product of conception, irrespective of the duration of the pregnancy, which, after such separation, breathes or shows any other evidence of life, such as beating of the heart." The plaintiff submitted the affidavit of a medical expert in pediatric neurology who conceded that the infant was born with a heartbeat and who never opined that the infant was stillborn. Next is the Larcy case on page 10, another medical malpractice case. The case deals with the presentation of a new theory that was first submitted in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's lack of informed consent cause of action in this medical malpractice case should have been dismissed. Plaintiff had alleged a new theory in response to defendant's motion for summary judgment, which should not have been considered because the theory was not discernible from the pleadings. The court wrote, "In opposition to the motion for summary judgment, the plaintiff alleged, for the first time, a new theory that the procedure performed by the defendant exceeded the scope of her consent in specific respects, a theory that was not referred to when the plaintiff's counsel questioned the defendant at his deposition. The assertion of a new theory was not discernible from the pleadings, nor alluded to by the plaintiff's counsel when deposing the defendant. Therefore, that theory should not have been considered." Next is Roisman on page 12, another medical malpractice case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the hospital defendant's expert's affidavit did not establish that the expert, whose name was D'Amico, was qualified to offer an opinion on several issues surrounding the birth process and therefore did not provide sufficient evidence to support the hospital defendant's motion for summary judgment. The court wrote, the expert affirmation offered by the hospital defendants lacked probative value because the expert, a physician who was board certified in the fields of obstetrics and gynecology, failed to lay a foundation for the reliability of his opinions in the fields of pediatrics, orthopedics, or anesthesia. Where a physician opines outside his or her area of specialization, a foundation must be laid tending to support the reliability of the opinion rendered. Where no such foundation is laid, the expert's opinion is of no probative value and is therefore insufficient to meet a party's burden on a summary judgment motion. Next is SAP versus County of Westchester. It's on page 13. It's a negligent supervision case against a municipality. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the negligent supervision cause of action against the county should not have been dismissed. Apparently, the infant plaintiff was injured in a county park by hot coals left after a fire. The court wrote, while a municipality is not an insurer of the safety of those who use its parks, it does have a duty to maintain its parks in a reasonably safe condition, which includes exercising ordinary care in providing an adequate degree of general supervision. The evidence submitted by the defendants in support of their summary judgment motion failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact as to whether they exercised adequate supervision of park visitors' use of fires and disposal of hot coals. Next is Alcon versus North Shore Towers, pages 13 and 14. It has to do with an injury caused by a power-operated door. The Second Department held the landlord, North Shore Towers, and the property manager, Greenthal Management, demonstrated the power-operated door which allegedly struck plaintiff as she walked through the doorway was not defective. Therefore, the defendant's motion for summary judgment was properly granted. The court wrote, here, North Shore Towers and Greenthal Management established their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that the subject door did not constitute a dangerous or defective condition. In support of their motion, they submitted evidence that they conducted daily inspections of the door, that the door activating system had been fully replaced 2 months before the incident, that after the new system had been installed, there had been no complaints of the door malfunctioning prior to the incident, and that the door functioned in accordance with industry standards. Next is Acevedo versus City of Yonkers, pages 14 and 15, slip and fall case against a municipality. Second Department affirming Supreme Court, but on different grounds. Held the water valve cap over which infant plaintiff allegedly slipped or tripped and fell while playing basketball in the street was a non-actionable trivial defect. Next is Curse on page 15, another slip and fall case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for a summary judgment in this sidewalk slip and fall case should not have been granted. Although there was a storm in progress at the time of the slip and fall, there were questions of fact whether ice had formed from a storm 2 days before and whether the defendants had constructive notice of that condition. The court wrote, while the defendants provided evidence of their general snow removal practices, they provided no evidence regarding any specific removal efforts following the January 24th storm, including on January 26th prior to the plaintiff's fall. Thus, the defendants failed to establish that the plaintiff slipped and fell on an icy condition that was a product of the storm in progress, or that they lacked constructive notice of a pre-existing condition. Next is Union versus Excel Commercial Maintenance on page 17, another slip and fall case involving a freshly waxed floor. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the contractor which waxed the floor where plaintiff allegedly slipped and fell did not owe a duty of care to the plaintiff because it was not demonstrated the contractor launched an instrument of harm. The court wrote, a defendant may not be held liable for the application of wax, polish, or paint to a floor unless the defendant had actual, constructive, or imputed knowledge that the product could render the floor dangerously slippery. In the absence of evidence of a negligent application of floor wax or polish, the mere fact that a smooth floor may be shiny or slippery does not support a cause of action to recover damages for negligence, nor does it give rise to an inference of negligence. Next is Johnson on page 19, another slip and fall case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this staircase slip and fall case should not have been granted. The defendant did not demonstrate it did not have constructive notice of salt used to melt ice on the steps. Supreme Court should not have, sua sponte, granted the motion on the ground the salt constituted a trivial defect because the parties didn't raise that issue. The court wrote, mere reference to general cleaning practices with no evidence regarding any specific cleaning or inspection of the area in question is insufficient to establish a lack of constructive notice. Here, in support of the motion, the defendant submitted the deposition testimony of the part-time porter and the deposition testimony of the property manager of the defendant's building, which merely provided evidence as to the defendant's general cleaning practices with no evidence as to when the area at issue was last inspected or cleaned prior to the accident. Supreme Court should not have granted the defendant's motion on the ground that the presence of the salt on the step at issue constituted a trivial defect because the parties didn't raise that issue. Next is the Casolari case on page 20, Second Department, another slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant homeowner's motion for summary judgment in this labor law section 200 action should have been granted. Defendant was not home when plaintiff fell through an open hole in the deck while removing a window. The defendant demonstrated he did not have any control over the manner of plaintiff's work and did not have actual or constructive knowledge of the dangerous condition. Supreme Court should not have considered the affidavit of a non-party who was not previously disclosed as a witness who had actual notice of the condition. Next is Crosbier versus New Horizons Resources, page 21, another slip and fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact about the cause of the fall, whether it was cracks in the asphalt. Also questions of fact whether the defendant had notice of the condition and whether the defect was trivial. Evidence the area was inspected once a month was not sufficient. Therefore, defendant's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted. The court wrote, the affidavit of the defendant's maintenance worker submitted in support of the defendant's motion referred only to his general inspection practices, but did not refer to any specific inspection in the area of plaintiff's fall relative to the date of the incident. Another employee of the defendant averred in an affidavit that she had inspected the driveway approximately 7 weeks prior to the plaintiff's fall and found all routes were clear of obstructions. She also averred that the defendant's maintenance department inspected the driveway at least once a month. This evidence was insufficient to establish prima facie lack of constructive notice. The defendant also failed to establish its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the basis that the alleged defect was trivial. The defendant failed to establish, prima facie, that the cracked condition of the driveway was trivial as a matter of law and thus non-actionable. Next is Saez versus Sapir Realty Management Corporation on page 22, another slip and fall. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined there were questions of fact about one, whether a sidewalk grate belonged to the abutting landowner, which was 11 Madison, or the utility, Con Ed, and two, whether the installation of the grate by the prior owner of the property constituted a special use of the sidewalk. The court wrote, Issues of fact exist as to whether the 11 Madison defendants' predecessors' installation of the non-standard vault grates constitutes a special use of the sidewalk by these defendants. There is evidence that the transformers in the vaults provided electrical services solely to their property. Next is DeBorba versus City of Rye, page 23. Another slip and fall case, second department. Held defendant, abutting property owner, demonstrated it was not responsible for the repair of any alleged defects in the public sidewalk in this slip and fall case. The city code imposed liability only if the landowner was notified of the need for repair. The court wrote, defendants established they did not receive notice from the Department of Public Works requiring them to perform sidewalk repairs. Accordingly, the defendants demonstrated, prima facie, that they had no statutory duty to repair the sidewalk. Next is Doe versus City of New York on page 24. It's a third-party assault case against the school district. The second department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for leave to file a late notice of claim should have been granted for the negligent supervision and negligent infliction of emotional distress causes of action against the Department of Education stemming from the sexual assault of the plaintiff on school grounds. The Department of Education had actual knowledge within the statutory period or a reasonable time thereafter of the facts constituting the claims which arose as a result of the alleged rape that occurred on September 28, 2017. In light of the Department of Education's actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claims of negligent supervision and negligent infliction of emotional distress, the plaintiff met her initial burden of establishing a lack of substantial prejudice to the Department of Education in maintaining a defense with respect to those claims. In opposition, the Department of Education failed to make a particularized evidentiary showing that it would be substantially prejudiced if the late notice with respect to those claims was allowed. Where there is actual notice and an absence of prejudice, the lack of reasonable excuse will not bar the granting of leave to file a late notice of claim. Next is Stenson on page 25, another third-party assault case. Second department held the defendant Casino's motion for summary judgment was properly granted. Plaintiff alleged she was drinking in defendant Casino and left with the man who had bought her drinks. The man sexually assaulted the plaintiff in a car. The court wrote, landowners in general have a duty to act in a responsible manner to prevent harm to those on their property. They have a duty to control the conduct of third persons on their premises when they have the opportunity to control such persons and are reasonably aware of the need for such control. However, a landowner's duty is limited to conduct on its premises, which it had the opportunity to control and of which it was reasonably aware. Here, the defendant demonstrated that it did not owe a legal duty to the plaintiff with respect to her subsequent off-premises sexual assault perpetrated by a man she met at a casino bar early in that evening. Next is Matter of Bingham versus Town of Wheatfield. It's a toxic torts case, and it has to do with filing late notices of claim against a municipality. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motions for leave to file late notices of claim in these actions stemming from pollution escaping from a landfill should have been granted. Although leave to file a late notice of claim cannot be granted after the statute of limitations has run, here the statute of limitations was told by the filing of a federal class action suit. The court wrote, although claimants failed to establish a reasonable excuse for the delay, the failure to offer an excuse for the delay is not fatal where actual notice was had and there's no compelling showing of prejudice to the respondent. Because respondent knew that its site was upgraded to a Class 2 site in 2015 and because similarly situated individuals serve timely notices of claim on respondent alleging substantively identical exposure to the site's pollutants and resulting damages, we conclude that claimants established that respondent received the requisite actual timely knowledge of the claims claimants now assert. We further conclude that claimants met their initial burden of establishing that respondent would not be substantially prejudiced by the delay, inasmuch as respondent has been investigating similar claims since early 2017, and that, in opposition, respondent failed to make a particularized showing of substantial prejudice caused by the late notice. Next is Ross, pages 26 and 27, a traffic accident case, rear-end collision, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held appellant's motion for summary judgment in this rear-end collision case should have been granted. Appellants demonstrated their vehicle was stopped when it was struck from behind by a vehicle driven by Bruce. Bruce's assertion that appellant's vehicle made a sudden stop was not sufficient to raise a question of fact. The court wrote, Bruce's bare assertion that the appellant's vehicle made a sudden stop without more was insufficient to raise a triable issue of fact as to whether the operator of the appellant's vehicle was partly at fault so as to defeat summary judgment. Next is Rojas, pages 27 and 28. It's another traffic accident case involving the insurance company and the doctrine of collateral estoppel. First Department, in a full opinion by Justice Renwick, after a comprehensive analysis of res judicata and collateral estoppel, refusing to follow the Second Department, held a default judgment in a declaratory judgment action brought against the plaintiff by the defendant driver's insurer Nationwide did not preclude plaintiff's subsequent personal injury action against defendants. Plaintiff alleged he was walking his motorcycle across a street when he was struck by defendant's vehicle. Nationwide brought the declaratory judgment action to obtain a ruling it was not obligated to pay no-fault benefits to plaintiff, and plaintiff didn't appear in that action. The court wrote, an issue is not actually litigated for collateral estoppel purposes if there has been a default. Claim preclusion cannot apply here because plaintiff and defendants are litigating a claim against each other for the first time. Next is Proce or Prose versus Town of Stony Point. It's another traffic accident case, this time against the municipality. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant police officer, name was Hurley, was engaged in an emergency operation when the officer's car struck the plaintiff's car as the officer made a turn onto the street where plaintiff's car was at a stop sign. Although the officer thought the urgency had diminished and had turned off the siren and lights, he was awaiting word that the emergency was over. The police had been called by a resident who saw someone on her porch who then ran into the woods. Another officer had stopped a man who explained he was looking for his dog. That story was being checked out when the accident occurred. The court wrote, the reckless disregard standard demands more than a showing of a lack of due care under the circumstances, the showing typically associated with ordinary negligence claims. It requires evidence that the actor has intentionally done an act of an unreasonable character in disregard of a known or obvious risk that was so great as to make it highly probable that harm would follow, and has done so with conscious indifference to the outcome. This standard requires a showing of more than a momentary lapse in judgment. Here, although Hurley's conduct may have constituted a momentary lapse in judgment, it did not rise to the level of reckless disregard for the safety of others. Next is Rodriguez Garcia on pages 29 and 30, another traffic accident case involving a police officer, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the defendant police officer named McMahon acted recklessly in this traffic accident case. The officer, responding to a call, passed a line of cars by straddling the yellow line without siren or lights and struck plaintiff as plaintiff was attempting to make a left turn. The court wrote, here the defendants established that the reckless disregard standard of Vehicle and Traffic Law 1104 was applicable to McMahon's conduct because he was responding to a radio call of a motor vehicle accident with unknown injuries. The defendants failed to establish their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law because their moving papers presented a triable issue of fact regarding whether McMahon was reckless in straddling the double yellow line to pass a row of vehicles without using his warning siren or lights when he collided with the plaintiff's vehicle. Next is Cabrera on pages 30 and 31, another traffic accident case involving a municipality. This time, the vehicle was a salt-spreading truck. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held a new trial was necessary on both liability and damages in this traffic accident case. Supreme Court had found the $12 million verdict excessive and had ordered a new damages trial. The accident occurred in a parking lot at LaGuardia Airport during a snowfall and involved a salt-spreading truck. Proof whether the parking lot was public or private should have been allowed because the reckless disregard standard, in the vehicle and traffic law would apply if the parking lot was public. The First Department further found that the defendant's accident reconstructionist should have been allowed to testify. The court wrote, plaintiff, an employee at a Dunkin' Donuts franchise in LaGuardia Airport, was involved in an accident with a salt-spreading truck operating in a parking lot in parking lot number 10 of the airport during a snowfall. The trial court erred in truncating proof on the issue of whether lot 10 was public or private. This error directly impacted whether the jury should have been charged with the recklessness standard as set forth in Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1103 or Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1163. The error in the charge warrants a new trial. The court also erred in precluding defendants' accident reconstructionist from testifying. The court's in limine inquiry of the expert concerning scientific studies was not relevant, as the subject of his testimony, accident reconstruction, and perception reaction time are not novel scientific theories, such as to require a Frey hearing. The proposed expert testimony was based on evidence in the record concerning the accident and was not entirely speculative. Similarly, defendant's notice of expert exchange was not insufficient, such as to warrant his in toto preclusion. The remedy for any alleged failures in specificity could have been handled by limiting his testimony to the subject matters listed in the exchange, citing CPLR 3101, subdivision D. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code, which would be placed on your attorney affirmation, for this July 2020 Negligence Update CLE course. The verification code is RECKLESS. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this July 2020 Negligence Update CLE course is RECKLESS. Next is Guerra versus Ditta. On page 31, another traffic accident case involving experts. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this rear-end collision traffic accident case should have been granted. Although Supreme Court was correct in finding that a Frey hearing was not necessary because biomechanical engineering is an accepted scientific theory, no proper foundation was laid for the defense experts, his name was Tusi, for his testimony. The court wrote, the court properly relied upon a decision of this court and a decision of the appellate term, First Department, in determining that biomechanical engineering is a scientific theory accepted in the field. Separate and distinct from the Frey inquiry is the admissibility question applied to all evidence, whether there is a proper foundation, to determine whether the accepted methods were appropriately employed in a particular case. The question is whether the expert's opinion sufficiently relates to existing data or is connected to existing data only by the ipsy dixit of the expert. Here, the defendant failed to establish that Tusi's opinions related to existing data and were the result of properly applied accepted methodology. Thus, Tusi's testimony should have been precluded. Next is Del Grosso versus Carroll on page 32, another traffic accident case, Second Department reversing Supreme Court, held the action was properly dismissed on forum non conveniens grounds in this traffic accident case. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court providently exercises discretion in granting that branch of the respondent's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 327A, to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against them on the ground of forum non conveniens. In granting that branch of the respondent's motion, the court properly considered all the relevant factors, including that the plaintiff and the respondents are residents of New Jersey. Defendant Carroll was also a resident of New Jersey at the time of the accident. Defendant Brian's insurance policy was issued in New Jersey, and both vehicles involved in the accident were registered in New Jersey. The fact that the accident occurred in New York is insufficient by itself to provide the substantial nexus required to warrant the retention of jurisdiction in the state of New York. Considering all of the relevant factors, including the fact that the plaintiff primarily received medical treatment for her alleged injuries in New Jersey, we find no basis to disturb the court's determination to dismiss the action insofar as asserted against the respondents on forum non conveniens grounds." Next is Brooks, page 33, another traffic accident case, intersection accident. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held plaintiff was not entitled to summary judgment in this intersection traffic accident case. Plaintiff was a passenger in a truck which apparently failed to yield the right-of-way and pulled into the path of defendant's car. The majority held there was a question of fact whether defendant saw what she should have seen when approaching the intersection. The dissenters argued defendant was entitled to assume the truck would yield the right-of-way. The court wrote, "It is well settled that a driver who has the right-of-way is entitled to anticipate that drivers of other vehicles will obey the traffic laws requiring them to yield," and it cites Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1142A. "Nevertheless, a driver cannot blindly and wantonly enter an intersection, but rather is bound to use such care to avoid a collision as an ordinarily prudent motorist would have used under the circumstances. Here, defendant's own submissions, including her own deposition testimony, raised an issue of fact whether she met her duty to see what should be seen and to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances to avoid an accident." Next is Hai Ying Zio versus Martinez, page 34, another traffic accident case involving a pedestrian this time. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff pedestrian's motion for summary judgment in this traffic accident case should have been granted. The court noted that evidence of a plaintiff's comparative negligence, although no longer an impediment to summary judgment, can be considered by the court where the plaintiff moves to dismiss a comparative negligence affirmative defense. The court wrote, "Even though a plaintiff is no longer required to establish his or her freedom from comparative negligence to be entitled to summary judgment on the issue of liability, the issue of plaintiff's comparative negligence may be decided in the context of a summary judgment motion where, as here, the plaintiff moved for summary judgment dismissing a defendant's affirmative defense of comparative negligence. The plaintiff established her prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the issue of liability by submitting her own affidavit, which demonstrated that she was walking within a crosswalk with the pedestrian signal in her favor when Martinez, who was attempting to make a left turn, failed to yield the right-of-way and struck her. The plaintiff's affidavit was also sufficient to establish that she was not at fault in the happening of the accident, as it demonstrated that she exercised due care by confirming that she had the pedestrian signal in her favor and by looking for oncoming traffic in all directions before entering the crosswalk, and that the collision occurred so suddenly that she could not avoid it. Next is Ramirez on page 35, another traffic accident case, intersection accident. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motion for a judgment as a matter of law, that's pursuant to CPLR 4401, was properly denied. But the motion to set aside the defense verdict in this intersection traffic accident case, pursuant to CPLR 4404A, should have been granted. Defendant violated the vehicle and traffic law by proceeding into the intersection on a road controlled by a stop sign. Whether defendant first stopped at the stop sign or went through the stop sign doesn't matter. The court wrote, the evidence established that the defendant violated vehicle and traffic law sections 1142A and 1172A. The defendant's statutory duty to yield to the plaintiff continued even after the defendant entered the intersection. Such statutory violations constitute negligence as a matter of law and could not properly be disregarded by the jury. Accordingly, the jury could not have returned a verdict that the defendant was not negligent on any fair interpretation of the evidence. And the final case, Gross versus Travelers Insurance, on pages 35 and 36. It's another traffic accident case, this time involving the supplemental uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant insurers' supplemental uninsured underinsured motorist benefits were triggered in the traffic accident case. The uninsured underinsured motorist coverage under plaintiff's policy was greater than the bodily injury coverage in the tortfeasor's policy. Plaintiff has settled for the tortfeasor's policy limit and then sought to collect the uninsured underinsured motorist benefits under his policy. Plaintiff's insurer had determined the policy was not triggered, and Supreme Court agreed. The court wrote, here, a comparison of the two policies at issue demonstrate that the plaintiff would be afforded greater coverage under his policy than under the tortfeasor's policy. Consequently, the underinsured and uninsured motorist provision of plaintiff's policy was triggered. That concludes this July 2020 Negligent Update CLE course.